Welcome. This week's show is sponsored by the Embroiderers Guild of America and Sassy Jack Stitchery. A new thing you want to note at the Embroiderers Guild of America is the 22nd Through the Needle's Eye exhibit. This will be displayed virtually at the 2023 National Seminar in Boston, and then as a three-month live display in Louisville, then on the EGA website. It'll include member original and adaptation needlework, and the theme is Celebrate the Diversity in Embroidery. Now, this is the 2023 National Seminar, but you need to note that the first step is to get registered, and that registration is open now through December 31. Quite a lead time on this, so get registered now if you want to participate, and all the details are in the events section of the EGA website. And then a new class that is being offered is Lazy Summer Day, taught by Judy Borison Caruso. And registration is open now through August 4. And of course, encourage you to visit the EGAUSA.org website. Lots of free things for non-members. The gallery is a treat to go through. And on top of all of it, join EGA. You won't regret it. So much to offer on so many fronts for needleworkers, and worth every penny. So join them, EGAUSA.org. Our other sponsor, Sassy Jack Stitchery, and Kim at Sassy Jack's, Kim and company getting ready to move into their new storefront, the Baird House, in early fall. So we look forward to that. And then, of course, we have projects that we're doing with Kim and Sassy Jack's, the Marion Lang sampler, the Mary Jane Fry 1861 sampler, the Botany Bay sampler, and the Take Wing sampler. All of those kits available at the Sassy Jack's website. And now here's an additional word from Kim.
Sassy Jack Stitchery is happy to be a sponsor of Fiber Talk. We so appreciate all the heart that Gary and team put into their show, and we always look forward to each episode. Thank you, Fiber Talk, for all you do for our needlework world. Sassy Jack's is a vibrant needlework shop located in the mountains of western North Carolina, just north of Asheville. We're in the process of moving our shop to its forever home in a historic folk Victorian on the National Listing of Historic Places, just 3 miles down the road from our current location. While we're moving, you can find us in all our normal online haunts, our website at sassyjackstitchery.com, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We can't wait to open our doors and welcome you into our new old home. It was always the plan to be in this beautiful old house, and we've invested a huge chunk of our hearts into its renovation. Every renovated board, every push-button light switch, every old porch swing has lovingly, mostly, been placed there with our own hands. It has a wonderful, warm, welcoming feel about the place already, and your stitchy joy and laughter with friends will really make it home for Sassy Jack's. So look for us online for the next few months, as we'll be filling online and phone orders as per usual, and we'll be looking forward to the spring at the Baird House in Asheville, North Carolina. When the time comes, we'll leave the light on for you, just like your mom did when you were a kid, so you'll know it's time to come home. Now on to the show.
Welcome back. I'm Gary Parr.
And I'm Beth Ellicott.
And you're listening to Fiber Talk, the twice weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, Melinda Sherbring. Melinda, welcome.
Happy to be here.
All right. Now, we have so many facets of you. This could be a four-hour show, I'm thinking. Yes.
Yeah.
Too many things. So we were talking before we started recording, and because you're computer science, NASA, worked on the Hubble telescope, electrical engineer, all of those things. And we're not gonna go through all of that, but it fascinates me, someone who operates at that intellectual level, and then what is it about needlework and your Society for Creative Anachronism and your teaching and design work, what is it about that? Is that all release? Is it hobby separate from? I mean, there's got to be a mental outing when you operate in the science world?
Well, as a systems engineer and software engineer, I have to be very precise. And with the I was a scribe long before I was a needleworker. And so these things are things that kind of get you out of the, it has to be this way and only this way.
Ah.
And it gets you into the flow kind of feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that's what you need.
Now, does that, when you do that, then is the other half of your brain, I assume, is still working on the problems of the day?
Oh, probably.
Yeah.
Because sometimes ideas pop up and you go, oh, where'd that come from?
Yeah. Yeah. So then, okay, so then you know, that established then, when you retire.
I retired in 2013 from aerospace.
Uh-huh. So now you got a whole half of mind that's free.
No, I find that I approach writing needlework instructions very similar to the way that I approached writing software usage instructions.
Ah, okay. So it's still there.
It's still there. And I find that people who are engineers or former engineers, and I know a fair number of women who are, they find those instructions very comforting because it talks about exactly what you do.
Ah, uh-huh.
Right. So, and I was going to ask, so does, I know you write articles too. So,
yes.
So do you find that also fulfills that other half need?
Well, this morning, for instance, I was trying to get ready for this and I'm going, okay, what do I do? What do I do? And I said, okay, calm down. Let's open up a document that I'm currently working on about a coif that I saw several years ago, and let's fix these three paragraphs. And so I looked over them and said, they could be better. And, you know, an hour later, I'd finished those three paragraphs fixing, and I was a lot calmer. And I said, okay, now we can go back to, is everything ready?
Yes. Okay, so that's what's interesting to me is that mental process when you have creative people is there's how the yin and yang kind of thing, how it works, because you have to have the structure, but then you got to have the art. And so how do those play off of each other? And so the structure settles you down, where for a lot of people, the art settles them down.
Well, the art is settling too.
Okay.
I mean, when I was in high school, I was sure that I was going to grow up and be an author and write science fiction. You'll notice that didn't happen. and in fact, when I went to college, I thought, okay, so I should take English. And the first day while we're trying to decide what to take, I'm going, okay, so if I take all these really cool English classes, oh, then what am I qualified for? To be a secretary. That is a fine profession, but one not for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I looked at my, you know, Lance or whatever SAT scores, SAT scores, and said, math. Math is just a language. Let's go major in math. And so that's kind of how I got onto the scientific track. It was purely on a what will I do with an English degree question.
Okay.
And then my sister is the real artist in the family. She's had actual art degree and so on. So I was the scientist, she was the artist, and my brother's the mechanical engineer.
now
nice
there's
balance.
Yeah, there's a Thanksgiving table discussion right there. Okay. Holy smokes. Yeah. But still some creativity in you, obviously.
Oh, I've been drawing and sketching and writing since I poked my nose in a book and discovered that you could actually write them yourself. And art is kind of the same way, is you see it, you can write it down. And my sister was a genius at drawing dragons and unicorns and things. So, so I learned from her, and she's younger than I am.
Yeah. Okay. Now, we mentioned in a recent show, actually, this is Sunday, so it was the Wednesday show was talking about that we were going to talk to you and the Society for Creative Anachronism, which was completely new to me, never heard of such a thing. And Beth knew of people, and then several people in the audience knew. Talk about that. How does that come about? What is that? What does that do? Because I'm most fascinated.
Well, the Society for Creative Anachronism started in the 1960s in Berkeley. And it was basically a protest against the 20th century. And they started with a tournament. The first people there were had been fencers, and so they had a tournament, and they had lords and ladies and all sorts of fun things. And what was supposed to be a one-off party kind of said, well, gee, this is fun. Let's do that again, and let's do that again. And pretty soon they were saying, well, if we're going to meet in a park, we need a name. And Marion Zimmer Bradley came up with the name, Society for Creative Anachronism. And that's kind of how it started in the late 1960s. I heard about it in 1972 at a World Science Fiction convention in Los Angeles. And I said, oh, this is fun. This looks like a real, oh, and you get to wear cool dresses. I've never been a big fan of wearing dresses. I like pants myself. But long to the floor dresses, and you look so elegant. And what? Oh, and they fight. I was a fencer too.
And they fight. Good.
And they do fight. It's fun to watch. But go
it
ahead.
Is.
Sorry.
And it's fun to do. So as a fencer, I said, well, this is kind of cool. This is sword and shield, not little skinny foils. And you're wearing real armor. Well, how do you get the real armor? I discovered that there were, I found this when I was in school, in grad school. And so I went back home to Las Cruces, New Mexico at that time, and found that there was a chapter near me, and they had a fighting practice. Oh, cool. So I got my whole fencing club to join, all both of us.
two?
Yeah, you need two to fence. What can
right,
I say?
Right.
And I was president, and my boyfriend was vice president, and then the next semester he'd be president and I'd be vice president.
That's tight. You know? That's really tight. That's good.
And you know, we found a few people, but mostly we were kind of languishing, saying, there's no one else to fight here. But with the SCA group, we go, oh. And so I'd borrow armor and get out there on the field and be whacked and die and get up and be whacked again and die, and it became kind of normal. Then when I got a job in 1975 out here in Los Angeles, I had a referral to someone who was in the SCA, Catherine Kurtz, who's also a science fiction author. And so I contacted her and said, you know, is there SCA out here? And she said, why, yes, there is. Come to X place at X time and join us. And I've been active in the Southern California version of the Society for Creative Anachronism ever since. I started as a fighter, but then decided that you can get hurt. And I didn't own a helmet, so I had to keep borrowing a helmet. And so I decided, well, maybe the fighting was more for watching than for doing. But there's all these other cool crafts that people are doing. And so at that point, I was more interested in calligraphy and illumination and heraldry. So I would go to the monthly heraldry meetings, and I was working with the scribes and so on, and learning about, oh, I discovered that insular manuscripts of the first century AD in Britain were my love. I adore them. And then I met person who was a relative of another person, you know how things go, who taught the dots method of making Celtic knotwork. Oh, eyes open, scream of joy. This was wonderful. I'm the sort of person that finds a rabbit hole, jumps down it, takes notes on the way. If I've reached the end and still am interested, I'll take those notes and write them up into an article. And then I'll run it by friends and say, did I miss anything? What am I missing here? Because people who review your work and just say it's wonderful are very nice and you say thank you. But yeah. People who review your work and say, I really was curious about X, or you introduced this but didn't tell me why you thought that. Those are the persons that you go, yes, read my next article.
Now, as part of this society, you actually create and in the activities become another person.
Yes, yes. One comes up with a persona. My persona is named Eowyn Amberdrake. Eowyn, because I was a great fan of Lord of the Rings, and you'll notice that she was a fighter too.
Yeah.
And so I said, Eowyn, it's Anglo-Saxon, Deutero theme, meaning horse, and wind, meaning joy. And Tolkien knew his Anglo-Saxon, so it must be a name, right? Right. Okay. Then I said, Amberdrake. Well, I like golden dragons, but golden dragon is just too easy.
Yeah.
And too odd and too kind of Chinese sounding. And it didn't sound Anglo-Saxon. So I thought, well, a synonym for golden might be amber colored, and a dragon could be a drake. So that became Amberdrake.
There we go.
Yeah.
Well, but see, the creativity is carrying through here because now you can take this, I'm sure, these personas as far as you want, but do we create an entire wardrobe and a different look for yourself? How far did you take it?
Well, the SCA has an official end cutoff date of 1600 and no official beginning cutoff date. So there's Romans, there's ancient Greeks and so on that show up at events. but I decided since I'd come up with the name Eowyn, I must be Anglo-Saxon. That put me in, about 650 AD. That's a good number because it's before Lindisfarne was sacked. I figured, okay, that also put me in good stead for doing all this fun stuff with Celtic illumination, except it isn't just Celtic. It's insular because the Anglo-Saxons did it too. And so I came up with Eowyn Amberdrake as a 7th century scribe. And I chose 650 because that's exactly, I was born in 1950, so 650, it was easy to figure out what age I was.
There we go.
And what year it was for me. And then I got interested in heraldry. Well, heraldry isn't really Anglo-Saxon. It's more, 12th, 13th, 14th century. So I've got a 13th, 14th century Eowyn Amberdrake, who's obviously a distant descendant of the original one. And that's where I did most of the later period scrolls and heraldry and so on. And then in the mid-90s, I discovered, in the late 1980s, when I went to England, I discovered Elizabethan stuff and said, okay, I'm going to be Elizabethan too.
Oh.
And so those are my three periods of most emphasis. And so my costumes are any of the above.
Okay. And you make your own costumes?
These days you can actually buy them.
Yeah.
Off the rack from Renaissance Fair people.
Okay.
But at the time, no. I mean, my very first costume was based on a Bellerophon coloring book. Hey, it was
right,
based
it worked.
On a painting, and it was mm-hmm. Elizabethan, and I didn't know about what all the underwear needed to be and so on. So it was a good faith attempt.
So, yeah, the undergarments are kind of a whole mechanism of themselves, aren't they?
Oh, absolutely. You need a hoop skirt to hold it out. You need a corset or a kirtle to hold yourself in. You need, you know.
But that's what makes it fun, because you have all this other stuff that we don't normally wear.
Right.
You know, anymore. Thank goodness, but, you know.
Right. And a friend of mine had an SCA wedding in the early 80s, and she wanted it to be Elizabethan. So for 6 months beforehand, we met every month, and we all worked on our clothing. And that was a much better Elizabethan.
Yeah. Now, all right. So then somewhere along here comes needlework?
Well, I was aware of it, but not really much until I became a member of the National Board of Directors of the SCA in 1984, and I was on that till 1988. And a couple years in, I'm sitting in the committee of the whole meeting that it takes an entire day before the real meeting, and I got to do something with my hands. I've got to do something. And so a friend of mine who is an avid cross stitcher said, here's some instruction on counted cross stitch. Oh, okay. So I would sit there during the committee meetings and stitch. And this is not an unusual thing to happen in SCA meetings, because everyone is assumed to do crafts. And if you're in a meeting, you can certainly keep doing your craft if it doesn't require loud noises or total attention. And the nice thing about needlework is once you get into the rhythm of it, it's almost meditative.
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. Yeah.
So that's your start in the middle of a meeting. Here's some instructions sorted out during the meeting.
Right. Hey. And then in 1991 or two, I don't remember which, a friend at work said, you do embroidery, right? Yeah. We're creating a new chapter of EGA close by. It'll meet every first of every month in the evening, so you can go, because most of the chapters met during the day and us working girls couldn't go. So I joined the chapter as it was starting, and that opened up a whole new world beyond counted cross stitch.
Yes. Oh, that's it. I remember when I joined, there was like all of a sudden it's not just doing counted cross stitch, it's all the other things, the needlepoint and
oh yeah. And I thought I'm firmly a counted stitch person. And then in 1996, I think it was, I went to National Seminar in San Francisco and took a class in Elizabethan embroidery. I was gone. It spoke to me. It said, hi, this is what you're meant to do. And so I kept doing it.
Now, so that's... okay, so Elizabethan. So now we're from cross stitch to surface embroidery and a much freer form of design then.
Yeah, yeah. Somewhere in there, it's kind of an adjunct to the Society for Creative Anachronism. In 1988, a friend of mine organized a costume tour of England to celebrate the defeat of the Spanish Armada. We had to all learn a British accent and have several costumes. And we were all in Elizabethans, and we sang and danced. This was part of the beginnings of interpretation by historical reenactors at venues. So we were at Coombe Sydenham and Wingfield College and various places that I can't even remember, Holdenby House, and we're inhabiting it for a weekend or two or so. And tourists came in and were agog at people in garb and wow, because this was before it became common. At the end of the tour, the rest of us went home, and our organizer presented a paper at a conference about this concept. Uh-huh. And so we were among early adopters, shall we say.
Yeah. And then now, so as you get involved in the needlework, then you stay pretty true to the ancient world of needlework. I mean, you've done an awful lot of study of old stitches and a lot of your designs have a very old feel to them.
Well,
in a positive way. Don't get me wrong, in a positive way.
No. And I agree, because as I got into it, I discovered that, okay, for instance, blackwork. If you take a blackwork class these days, they will talk about thread thickness and design density and how to shade within a motif using patterns of blackwork and so on. And I wasn't seeing any of that in the historical blackwork, and I'd seen a fair amount by this time, and mostly in books, but a little bit in person. And I'm going, okay, so historical blackwork would have, for instance, a petal of one pattern, and maybe the next petal would be a different pattern, or maybe it would be the same pattern, but they didn't shade from paler to darker within the petal. And all of my blackwork teachers, because I took blackwork from some very excellent EGA and ANG, American Needlepoint Guild, teachers. Marian Scholar, I love taking her class, but she's teaching me all this modern stuff. And I'm going, oh, so there's modern blackwork and there's 16th century blackwork. And in fact, 16th century blackwork, well, in the SCA, mostly people were using blackwork as the name of the stitches that go around the ruffles or the cuffs or things like that. So basically linear things, not filled things. Oh, there's lots of and some of them are filled with patterns and some of them are filled with spots, just little tiny dots. Like they're trying to imitate a woodcut. And so the more I kept looking at historical stuff, particularly in books at this time in the mid-90s, but the more I saw that there were a lot of different kinds of black work and that there was modern kinds, and so I certainly appreciate modern black work as well, but I want to make sure that people are aware that there are lots of different things that come under the name black work.
Yeah. So now you've opened my eyes, because I know enough about black work to be dangerous. and so my assumption was that when we see these sophisticated black work designs with different thread thicknesses and shading and all the beautiful things you see, that was the pinnacle of ancient black work, but quite the opposite.
No, it was very different. They would have, say, a pansy, and the two top petals would be one pattern and the three bottom petals would be a different pattern. And one of the patterns might be visually more dense than another, but there would not be any shading in it. If you wanted shading, what you were probably going to do is use dots, because the dots part, they had some that were seeding, that is just a running stitch going down and then a running stitch coming back parallel to it and so on. So you've got a lot of little seeds, as it were. But there were also ones that used a black and a white thread in the same needle, twisted, and then you do long and short stitch. And it gives you the effect of dots. And if you did long and short stitch just on the edges, which they sometimes did, and often did actually when they're using this technique, you would have a large blank area, and then you would have a speckled or heathered area. And then they might have put long and short stitch in just black at the very edge so that you have a gradation of shades. But it wasn't because they changed anything in a pattern. It was because they were using long and short stitch, and they were using two threads. And you go, whoa, that's
that
different.
That is interesting. Yeah, fascinating. Because I've done some black work, but not a lot, enough to be dangerous. And I was never taught that, again, from modern,
right.
From modern perspective.
Right. Oh, the modern stuff seems to date from about the very early 1900s.
Oh, my.
And there's some really cool stuff being done.
Yeah.
And
but see, the techniques you just described, though, see, to me, you know, that's another open door in terms of how to approach needlework. It seems like, yep, every time that we talk about these kinds of things, we discover that there's another way, that there's not this prescribed way that you must do everything. There's another way to achieve a look that someone else has tried and had success with. It's interesting.
Yeah, I think some of the styles of black work in the 1600s and 1500s were imitating printing.
Uh-huh.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Possibly. Right, because they didn't know how to print, correct? I mean, to print on fabric was difficult to do, correct?
Right. And some of them actually seem to have done that. But if you open up a book that has a woodcut in it of a flower, that woodcut will probably be shaded with straight lines. And so just straight lines is a style of black work that go through part of them. In fact, I started collecting instances, and I have something I call Black Work Anthology. I started it in about 1996 or so, 97. And it's little pieces of designs from historical pieces and from modern pieces that have different styles of things that have been called black work. And I'm up to like 12, 15, something like that, different styles.
So, and may I ask what you're going to do with this information, if you're going to publish it so all of us can enjoy it?
Eventually, somehow, I'm trying to figure out how, because I've got the ones that I finished by the early 2000s, I hand-bound it into a book with it's called a Black Work Anthology, because anthology is a collection of flowers, and so all of these are flowers. And the idea is each one is a page, and then it is followed by a page that says, this is where the design comes from and what we know about it, you know, whether it was done with silk thread, flat silk, or whatever. And then how I did the reproduction as close as possible to the real thing. But when I was working in the 1990s, I didn't know how to do plaited braid. So I had to choose something else because I didn't know plaited braid. And they were doing it, and I couldn't figure it out from Mrs. Christie's descriptions in her samplers and stitches from the 1900s. It just wasn't working for me. And no one was teaching it. No one was. I took the Tudor class in 1996 at the seminar because I was hoping I'd learn plaited braid, and I didn't. I learned many other things that I am delighted to know, but I did not learn plaited braid.
Now, what carries you to Master Craftsman?
Well, in EGA, there is a program called Master Craftsman. It's 6 steps. First step is counted cross stitch, and I thought, I got that one nailed. Second one
did you?
Was yeah, I did.
Okay.
I got, I did.
Or did you get surprised?
I've finished through number 4. But the 5th step, I haven't. I designed my own stuff for each step because that's, I'd rather do my stuff than someone else's. So I did the counted cross stitch and I did the Assisi based on a design as if it were a. It reminded me of white vine, Romanesque. White vine is the Renaissance. Romanesque is the 1200s version, where you've got manuscripts that have decorated initial letters with colors behind and a white vine in front. And so I chose to draw a dragon in the form of an S and put some scribes in the background, kind of looking back and forth at each other going, huh, how come the dragon's bigger than us? and so that was my design for the Assisi. And then for black work, I did a couple of, in the 1988 trip, I took some pictures of members of our troop dancing. So I took those photos and turned them into black work patterns. And then, let's see, what next was white work. And for that, I used Pictish crosses. I like the idea of using stone carved symbols reproduced in lace.
Wow. Okay.
A little juxtaposition there.
Yeah. I mean,
okay. A question. Do you ever do anything normal?
Yeah, I do take classes and sometimes I even finish them.
Okay. So the white work, and then is that where you're at now?
I finished the white work, and the next step is Hardanger, and I haven't gotten inspired properly for Hardanger, and so it's been 10 years since I've done the last one, and so I'll have to rejoin the program if I want to finish it, but Hardanger, and then the last one is combining any three or four of those, and I'm going, okay, that part's easy. It's the I came up with a really cool idea for Hardanger, but decided that I didn't want to stitch forever because it was treating each square as a pixel and making a design that way, and I decided that was more trouble than it was worth.
So then does design come out of this effort, or is you're designing a separate parallel path?
Pretty much in the SCA and in my time up before the SCA, the impetus has always been to look around, draw something and stitch that or draw that or whatever. And in the SCA, there's a lot of emphasis on doing your own thing in the style of. So either you're reproducing something exactly or you're using it as inspiration for your own stuff. That's the creative part. And one of the things that people do a lot of in the SCA is if you have a fighter on the field, you give them a favor. And to wear on their belt. So it's just a piece of cloth with something on it that says, hi, I support you. And usually it's got an object pictured on it. So in mine, I usually picture a dragon. And then I would give it to my husband and he'd wear it on the field. And eventually it would get all beat up. So I'd have to do a new one. in the early 2000s, I read a story in Fine Lines, an article by Leon Conrad. And he talked about how he figured out the plaited braid on an existing article. Now, this was mind-blowing in two ways for me. One was, oh, I understand it. Now I can do it. Yay. And the second one is, oh, here is a way to look at items, embroidered items, and figure out what's going on. Oh, that's a rabbit hole. I'm going to jump right down, feet first. So thanks to that, and backing up slightly, in 1999, I was asked to pilot a new program for ANG called Master Needle Artist. And I thought, oh, sweet bags. Those are really cool. I like Elizabethan sweet bags. I'm going to do that. And then the guidelines came out, no Elizabethan embroidery.
Oh, no.
Oh, that's too bad.
So I switched entirely and said, okay, I will combine quilts and Pictish art and crewel work. Okay, I'm doing that for Master Needle Artist. But the sweet bags, of course, I'd already started down that rabbit hole. And so I was already researching it. And I thought, you know, this way I'm not doing their version of what I should be looking at and doing. I'll do my version of what I should be looking at and doing. So I started researching sweet bags, everyone I could find. Lynn Skinner led a needlework tour of England in about 2002, 2003, something. I'm not sure where or when and how it relates to that. Oh well, never mind.
Before you do that, for those who don't know, what is a sweet bag?
Ah. Okay, a sweet bag is a small pouch that's just slightly wider, usually, than it is tall. And if it's 5 inches tall, that's a really big one.
Okay.
And it's embroidered on both sides, usually entirely covered with embroidery. And it's got three tassels at the bottom. It's square. It's got three tassels at the bottom. It's got finger loop braided strings that allow you to close it, and it's got two little fancy things that I call openers at the edge of each side so that you can open it after you've closed it. And it has all sorts of really cool stuff on them. So when Lynn Skinner had this thing, I signed up, and then I said, okay, and I'm gonna see if maybe I can get behind the scenes at the V&A and their sweet bags. And I did. And I took another member of the group with me, and we had a blast. Took lots of pictures. Had to stop. My first reaction on seeing something close up, nothing between me and it but air, is to just stare and go, gah. That doesn't help, and the drool can't go that far.
Right.
So I need a second person with me to say, so what do you see here? Oh, yes, and take pictures and take notes and so on. So it really helps to have a second person there, because otherwise I am just in awe of this 400-year-old thing that someone spent months working on.
Yeah. People talk about the V&A, I mean, with such reverence. That must be an amazing place.
Oh, it is. It is. It is.
Here, let me say, that must be an amazing place.
It is, Gary. One of these days you'll have to go.
Oh, you've been?
Yes.
Oh.
And I didn't go behind the scenes. I just toured the rooms, and I could have lived there. It was fabulous.
Yeah, they used to have a room upstairs. It was just their needlework cabinets. Oh, I first went there in 1988 when we were on the England tour as performers, and we had a day off, and we were taking those out and looking at them and taking pictures, and oh, it was just wonderful. And when I found out you could go behind the scenes if you ask nicely and you know are polite and they have time and room and stuff, you know, there's many things. So for instance,
right.
The latest place I asked about we're going, no, thanks to COVID we aren't open.
Oh.
Right. I know. Yeah.
Now, is that when you go behind the scenes, is that fully supervised, full white glove?
It is definitely fully supervised. I do not get to touch the items usually.
Okay.
And usually, sometimes there it is fully supervised. At the V&A, it certainly was. But for instance, at the Norwich Embroidery Center, they pulled out everything we asked for, put it on the table. They were within... often, many of them were within plastic so that no one could actually touch them, but not all of them.
Yeah.
And then the two of us were left to pursue our dream.
Okay. So you're able to sit there and take pictures and get up close and study and really evaluate how the needlework was done then.
Well, at that point when I'm actually confronted with something sitting there, I have a whole museum kit that I take with me. And the first time I went behind the scenes, it was in Nottingham, and I didn't know what I was getting in for. They had a wealth of things, and I just asked to see everything they had for 16th century. There was not enough time. But they were very kind, and and the rest of my party had gone on to London, and this was before cell phones, so it was kind of okay. I'll meet you at this train station in London when I'm done, at this time, and you know I'll take the X train out, and because so they left in the morning and I left in the afternoon, and we met. But in the meantime, I had spent the morning with the curator and his assistants and some of the most amazing stuff I've ever seen. And more fool I, did I ask to take pictures? No.
Oh.
So I just took notes.
Oh.
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 I had no rulers. So after that, I figured out that one, you should ask if you could take pictures. Two, you should have a kit to go with you. And in that kit should be a ruler and a pencil and paper. And I added a few more things over the years, such as a color reference.
Mm-hmm.
Then I added a threads reference. I did a sampler of threads for all of the different weights of blackwork thread that I had handy, and I take that with me, and so I can say, ah, the thread on this, even if it's silk, is about equal to one strand of DMC floss.
Yeah.
Or I could say it's really the size of floche, or you know, whatever. And so and then I said, ah, I have lots of different gold threads. Let's make a sampler of gold threads too.
Uh-huh.
Right.
And so I've got that I bring with and say, and admittedly, I'm not using calipers to measure. I'm using by eye and taking pictures.
Right.
But it does give me some sense of how fine some of the things they were working really was.
Yeah. So if I have a chance to do that kind of thing, go behind the scenes, it sounds to me like if I just go in to see the world, I'm almost wasting my time, that I should do
yes.
research ahead of time and say and narrow down to what I'm really interested
Absolutely.
In.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I want to get back to Nottingham with all of my stuff and have several days until they throw me out.
Right, right.
But,
which they will do.
Oh, yeah. But I found that in England, if you give them a heads up far enough ahead of time and an idea of what you're looking for and looking at, they are happy to make it possible if they can. I mean, I absolutely understand if no one's there to babysit me, then no one's there to babysit me. And so,
yeah,
you know, that's fine. But I asked and that's when I discovered that if you don't ask, you don't get.
Yeah. I got to believe that for those curators, there's a real sense of pride and ownership in the collections that you need to be sensitive to.
Oh, absolutely. But what I learned going behind the scenes at the LA County Museum of Art, that the curator of the collection is a curator of vastly more than just my little piece of it, right?
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so I may say, oh, look, that's a buttonhole stitch. They may be taking notes.
Oh, okay.
And what I do generally after I've been to a collection, I didn't do this at first because I didn't think of it, but I'm kind of catching up on some now, is send the curator with my thank you note, and this is what I observed.
Hmm.
And that opened the doors to LACMA for me because I had a half hour with a group seeing about five things at a conference we'd created through the SCA for Northern California and Southern California people. And one member of our group was on the board, one of the review boards in LACMA. And she said, well, I think I can get us behind the scenes to see like some stuff. And we said, yes. And they said, okay, we've got room for five people at a time, maybe seven in this little place, and we can show you seven things.
Mm.
And she's for 1 hour. And so we came back and said, could we have half an hour with seven people per?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And we did. And that, so then I wrote up what I had seen, sent it back to the curator with my thank you note, and she said, when can we have you back?
Oh, okay.
Nice.
So, it was lovely. Now, usually when you go behind the scenes, you can take all the pictures you want for your own purposes, but if you want to publish them, that's a separate, deal.
Yeah.
And I'm currently going through some hoops. I just went through those hoops for some from the MFA Boston, and I've got those observations posted to academia.
Mm-hmm.
So
the overall message, if you get to do this kind of thing, is don't charge in there American style. Use some discretion, plan ahead,
absolutely.
Communicate, share.
You have summarized it beautifully.
Okay. Yay, me. All right. Now, of course, we're going to run out of time. So let's talk about what you're doing these days, because now Beth's group is going to work on one of your designs. Which one is that, Beth?
More Than a Rose. We're signing up through the lightning round through EGA.
Oh, good. And, good, good.
And lots of discussions going around and about in the group. They were pretty excited.
Delighted to hear that.
I had a couple of people say, oh, it's intermediate. And then they looked at it and I said, it's 10 stitch and making your own decisions. We will hold your hand if that's the only thing you don't know how to do. We can help you.
Right. That's basically it. More Than a Rose is a group correspondence course based on a sweet bag idea. That is, it's half the height and exactly the width of a sweet bag. And it's only one side. But the idea is these are things that are stitches that were found on sweet bags. And I do teach plaited braid because I think it's kind of the ne plus ultra of Elizabethan embroidery. And so you gotta learn it. You really do. But I try to make it easier to learn by breaking it down into first learn where the thread goes and learn it on something really big, like, say, 7-count plastic canvas. Mm-hmm. I want you to know where that thread's going. And once you've figured that out, then you can try doing it at size with the metal thread, or first with pearl cotton, if you like. But pearl cotton is a very limp thread, and the metal thread has a mind of its own, and you must tame it.
Yes. Because I took Catherine Jordan had a sweet bag in an AGA magazine ages ago, and we did that several of us did that as a group.
Uh-huh.
And I remember that gold thread, I think we were just doing chain stitch with it. I know we didn't do plaited. That's what's interested a lot of our group. They're like, we don't know how to do this one stitch, we've got to take this class.
Well, and I had a lot of different varieties of Ceylon stitch in there too, because Ceylon stitch, if you've got it with a very short rung, it looks almost like plaited braid. So if you have a situation where you're wanting plaited braid and it just doesn't make sense to you, only experts will notice the difference between plaited braid and a close together Ceylon.
Okay, now that's another stitch. I don't know, maybe the other ladies do. So that'll be very exciting to learn.
I think you'll find it's a lot easier.
Oh, good.
There's your out, Beth, right there. There's your out.
Yep. There's my out.
Yep.
And we did talk about doing the sweet bag. And I don't remember the name of that one. It's
The what?
Don't you have a sweet bag for the group
course? Sweet bag, yes. That's the other group correspondence course. And that one is at size, both sides, and has an ungodly amount of stitching on it. It took me 4 years.
Oh. Okay.
But it's in exactly the right style, and it's probably got more things in the more than a rose, more techniques than the sweet bag does. But the sweet bag takes a lot of effort, and there's information in there on how to assemble it.
Mm.
And so making the bits and pieces that are needed to assemble it, the different kinds of tassels, and even as a special extra credit, a Turk's head knot.
Why not? So now, right. What is life like today? Is it designing and teaching? Are you doing it three-quarter time? What?
Well, these days, given the pandemic,
yeah.
I thought the only reason I hadn't updated my website was because I didn't have enough time. I was wrong. I had plenty of time and still didn't do that. But I've been designing stuff. I'm, in fact, putting together various things that I'm teaching next year. I'll be at Greater Pacific Region seminar next year, also at the New York National Seminar, teaching a couple Elizabethan classes, and some Zoom calls to do chapter programs, and all sorts of fun things.
Yeah. Have you found it fairly easy to adapt to the Zoom format, or still a little bit of a battle?
Well, of course, technology is my bailiwick, and I still have problems, as you've noticed. But I'm also not afraid to just say, okay, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this, let's try this. Let's unplug it and plug it back in.
Yeah.
Turn it off and turn it back on.
Yep. So Zoom, and I've got a separate camera for zooming the close-up of how you do the stitches. So yeah. That helps.
Yeah, there's a boom business right there, cameras for that kind of thing. That somebody's made a lot of money in the last couple of years just on those. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Now, do you, discussions we've had recently, I assume that you see online courses as part of your future, just as an ongoing normalcy?
I like to be able to say, hey, here's a cool idea. I'd love to share it with people. And by the way, they're making it worth my while to share it with them so that I don't get too distracted going off doing something else, because mm-hmm. I am a person of rabbit holes.
No, well, and that's what makes you so fascinating. Yeah, I mean, look at all the things we've covered just in the past hour. Yeah.
Right.
No boredom in your camp.
No.
Well, Melinda, this has been a treat. Thanks so much for making the time. Really have enjoyed it.
I've enjoyed it, too. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, and thanks to everybody for listening.